Okay, questions? Okay, I've had a couple of questions when it comes to, well, I guess it's most relevant for 2D, about, you know, what is inference and how do you do inference on ratios of means. And while we will eventually be given the formula and a few lectures on how to do that, I was happy with you just talking about how it affected the point estimate. Right? Point estimates are part of inference, as are confidence intervals are part of inference, as are p-values part of inference. But on those, it's enough to look at how the point estimates change. I did get a question about, and you know, what do you mean by a point estimate being inference? And I'll answer that here again, just as I answered it then, in an impossibly vague way, but it's true. The same number that you're using as a descriptive statistic might be an inferential point estimate if that's the way you're using it. So the idea is when you look at a sample and I say, I took all of these, the average of all of these numbers, and that average was 10.3. That's a descriptive statistic. I'm just telling you about the sample. But then when I say, because my sample mean was 10.3, I am guessing that that is also the average of the entire population. That's inference. So it's inference if you use it that way. So it gets even worse than that in statistics. Something is an estimator if I'm using it to estimate something. What makes it an estimator? So my favorite estimator is 14, and I use it to estimate everything. You know, sometimes it's not a very good estimator, but it's an estimator nonetheless. I also got asked, I was all prepared just to completely cancel the project, but somebody in discussion section this morning asked if I was going to assign it, so now I feel constrained to do so. Do you want the name and who to beat up after? I will be sending that out later today, as the by the project assignments and what's all involved there. Other questions? Okay. Then we're talking about inference for binomial proportions. And we're going to talk about that first, what we do in large samples. So variables that take on two values, we'll, for convenience, code them as 0 or 1. Obviously, vital status, sex, or perhaps a treatment variable there. Other times, for scientific reasons, we dichotomize variables. It's statistically less precise to do so, so you'll find a lot of statisticians saying, why do you want to dichotomize your data? And then you will be prepared for saying, it's the scientifically relevant thing to do, because if it weren't the scientifically relevant thing to do, you never would have done it. So, but there's many times, many, many times that for scientific reasons, we decide to dichotomize the data. So the scientific questions are then translated into a statistical question about the parameter P, which is just the mean of the distribution. A binary variable has to have a Bernoulli distribution, where P is just the proportion with the random variable equal to 1. So our point estimate, why not use the sample mean? We have a tendency to call it P hat in this case, but it's really just X bar. Just really the average of all those 0, 1 variables. The variance in this case, however, is not an arbitrary sigma squared like we've been treating it before. In fact, the variance has to be P times 1 minus P. So there's this mean variance relationship. You can't change the mean without changing the variance. This is the very first central limit theorem that was ever described, was the fact that the mean of binary data looks normally distributed across replicate samples. And so p hat is approximately normally distributed with mean p and variance p times 1 minus p over m. Now, why I focus so much on this mean variance relationship is because it does affect the way that we do confidence intervals and testing, and it leads to some unpleasant things in our lives, like where the tests don't agree with confidence intervals and things like that, sort of by habit. And it all ties into how we're treating the mean variance relationship. Because the number of events is discrete, we often make a continuity correction. So instead of saying that p hat is less than or equal to k over n, we say that p hat is less than or equal to k plus 0.5 over n, just to use up that difference. But I do make the distinction. In the one sample problem, we do this. When I come to the two sample problems, I won't make this continuity correction, because as a general rule, the continuity correction on the two different proportions you're comparing sort of cancel each other out, so it doesn't make much difference. But in the one sample problem, we do tend to make this correction. And so in our confidence interval, the best approach, we would look at p hat plus or minus a critical value times a standard error, but we would do the continuity correction. So we take p hat minus 1 over 2n. So that's the one half of the sample size. We use the z critical value. But then as I compute the standard error, I compute the standard error under my hypothesized value, not under my observed value. So I'm trying to say, for what value of pl might I have observed p hat? So I put the standard error in computed with PL. How many of you really like that equation, right? It's just a quadratic equation, and you all remember that, right? You know, negative b plus or minus square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. Right? So, yeah, most people don't really do this. But if you do this, it will be much better behaved. Much better behaved. So to get the lower bound of the confidence interval, I'd have to solve this quadratic equation, or I'd have to just guess and see when it worked. Same with the p hat upper. I would then use the standard error computed using that p hat upper. But for elevator statistics, which is when I'm usually doing this without a computer, I'll just plug in p hat times 1 minus p hat. And so long as n times p and n times 1 minus p are large enough, this behaves pretty well.
Sorry.
Yes?
I didn't understand
what the continuity correction is? Well, if I've only got 10 observations and I have observed 5 successes out of those 10, I can't observe a probability of 0.55 or 0.45. I can observe 0.5 or 0.6. So I go ahead and I split it at 0.55 instead of splitting it at 0.5. So I don't say, well, what probability of me observing 0.5 or less? That's the same as the probability of observing 0.55 or less with only 10 observations.
And how do you do that?
Well, in real life or conceptually?
Real life and conceptually.
Yeah, so in real life, I don't usually bother because I use a computer to do this.
And they're ready.
Most computer packages will go ahead and put in the continuity correction on the one sample problem. Stata goes one step further and just use exact things. So on the one sample problem, we don't do one sample problems all that often. Most times we do two sample problems, and so we're there. But that's the purpose. It's just fine tuning. But all of this is to explain why when one person says, I got a confidence interval of this, somebody else says, I plugged it into a different program and got this other one. They might not agree by a tiny bit just by variations in how they do these things. But, you know, again, it's too much trouble for me to put in the continuity correction when I'm just standing in an elevator. But I can very often do a rough approximation of this where I say p hat plus or minus 2 times p hat times 1 minus p hat over n. So the asymptotic p-values, of course, if you were trying to test the hypothesis that p equals p0, we really ought to compute the p-value using that null hypothesized value. So P0, that's what we would usually do. So it ends up looking very much like the t-test, but the t-test, were you to use the t-test with this data, it would differ in two ways. One is we'd be using the t-distribution, not the standard normal. And the other aspect is the t-test would use the sample variance, and the sample variance will be estimating p-hat times 1 minus p-hat. Not P0 times 1 minus P0. Okay, so that would just differ a little bit. If you plug things into the t-test to do this, in large samples, that would be the correct thing to do. There's no problem. But in moderate size samples, we'd get a slightly different because we would instead use this model-based estimate of the variance, P0 times 1 minus P0. And again, with elevator statistics, I just dropped the continuity correction. But when I'm doing a test, I do use the hypothesized value rather than p-hat. To get asymptotic inference out of Stata, well, Stata in the commands that we use actually gives exact inference, except in a very few functions where it has to compute things. It'll go off into asymptotics a little bit, but it's not real clear what it's doing. So if you wanted the asymptotic inference in Stata, you could compute the standard errors, do z statistics, and use the norm function to get the p-values. But why not just use the exact inference? It's easier and it's better. Yes?
I don't see the difference between exact inference and asymptotic.
So asymptotic inference is an approximation to what the real distribution is. That's all. And it works in large samples. It's a good approximation in large samples. But the exact will actually use the more complicated formula I'm going to get to in just 1 second. And I think you'll agree that standing on an elevator, you'd rather use the asymptotic results. So the exact inference. So here, I don't have to rely on asymptotic theory. A binary variable must be Bernoulli. The sum of independent Bernoullis must be binomial, and we can use the exact distribution to compute our probabilities. And this is the formula we're using down in the right-hand side, and we all remember, of course, that n factorial is n times n minus 1 times n minus 2 times n minus 3, so on. So n factorial over k factorial over n minus k factorial times p to the k times 1 minus p to the n minus k. And all you have to do is add that up for a bunch of different k's, and then you get the probability you want. Okay, so this is why we don't do this by hand. We don't do this by hand. But this is the formula that the computer can use without much problem. So we still use the sample mean. We still use p hat is equal to x bar. But we use a binomial distribution to search for the value of PL and PU such that that sum adds up exactly to those values. So very complicated thing to do. To get that exact confidence interval, in Stata, you say CI, you put in your variable, and then you type binomial. And it knows that then you don't have to tell it. It knows not to compute the sample variance to get things. It knows to use the binomial distribution. So in the PSA data set, where I might look to see if you had relapse in 24 months, in this data set, nobody was censored before 24 months, so it was okay to do this. And I created a variable that was relapse 24. I also created a variable that said whether the nadir was greater than or equal to 2. I could look at the prevalence of relapse within 24 months by asking for the confidence interval for relapse 24. It told me that the estimate was that 44% relapse within 24 months, but my confidence interval goes from 30% to 58.7%. I could do specificity and sensitivity because those are just proportions. Well, And so by looking within the group who did not relapse within 24 months, so this I would be looking at my 1 minus specificity, or looking at those who did relapse within 24 months, I'd be looking at my sensitivity of a nadir greater than or equal to 2. And we see that 1 minus the specificity is estimated to be 14.3% with a confidence interval from 4% to 32.7%. The sensitivity is estimated to be 68.2% with my confidence interval from 45.1% to 86.1%. So the key point is those are just proportions that I'm estimating, sensitivity, specificity, prevalence, so I can just use these methods for a one sample binomial proportion. So interpretation, observed prevalence of relapse, 44%, was not unusual if the true prevalence or where between 30% and 58.7%. With 95% confidence, I would reject that the prevalence was less than 30% or that the prevalence was greater than 58.7%. Similarly, the observed sensitivity of 68.2% might typically be observed in studies like I did if the true sensitivity were anywhere between 45.1% or 86.1%. The observed specificity, here I just subtracted, right? I took my estimate and I took my confidence interval. I subtracted it from 1 because what I had estimated was 1 minus the specificity. So observed specificity of 85.7% was not unusual if the true specificity were anywhere between 67.3% and 96%. I could compare this to the asymptotic confidence intervals using the t-statistics. Normally, I'd use z-statistics, the standard error is by the square root of n over n minus 1, and the critical values differ. And then we also have that the mean variance relationship is not being handled the same way. So if I just did this, we find that we get very similar results. The sample means, of course, are exactly the same, but you can see that in this sample size of 50, it's pretty close, but it's not exact. So we had the 39.7% and 58.3% instead of the 30% and the 58.7%. So asymptotics hold very well very soon. A very interesting problem comes up when you have observed zero events in N trials. Okay, on your homework, many of you have no doubt discovered and asked you to get the idea of what happens, you know, what's the probability of vitamin E going down, and it didn't everybody. Didn't have a very large sample size, though, right? So the question is, when you don't have that large sample size, how do you get a confidence interval? Asymptotic results of that p hat times 1 minus p hat breaks down on you because if p hat is 0, then you're estimating there is no variability, and you just cannot get a confidence interval that way. But we do have some other ways to get that, and this will be based on asymptotics. It'll be based on an approximation later. But if you have y equals 0 or y equals n, you can't get a two-sided confidence interval, but we can get a one-sided confidence bound. So if you have observed zero events, I can solve some algebra to say that 1 minus p raised to the n is equal to alpha. Go through some math, so that means p is equal to 1 minus alpha raised to the 1 over n. The 1 over nth root, so the nth root of alpha is what? Yeah. But it turns out that I can take the logarithm, so the n of n times log of 1 minus p is equal to log of alpha. For small p, which given we haven't observed any events, p is likely to be small. So for small p, the log of 1 minus p is approximately negative p. And so we would have to bet that for large n, p hat is approximately negative log of alpha over n.
Log of 0.05 is negative 2.9957, which has been judged close enough to 3 for most people's use. And so we have this 3 over n rule. In large samples, when zero events have been observed, the 95% upper confidence bound for p is approximately 3 over n. 99% upper confidence bound, this is, of course, the famous 4.605 over n rule. Yeah, I've never heard of it. But the idea is you just switch it to some other value, 99% upper confidence bound. How good is this approximation? Well, certainly if n is 2, it's not very good since 3 over 2 is 1/5. It's also not very helpful. But as we get to n equals 10, 0.2589, whereas our approximation would be 0.3, at 20, 0.1391, our approximation would be 0.15. At 30, 0.095 versus 0.10. It's looking pretty good there. Okay, so again, it's just a very rough idea. This matters a lot for those of you who are in basic science and are in the habit of, I did my experiment 3 times and I got the same result, and therefore the way it always is. You might not believe that so much. Similarly, this pertains to the, I launched a space shuttle 24 times and nobody died, and therefore it's perfectly safe. The fact that the 25th launch of the space shuttle blew up. Turns out that our confidence bound after the first 24 successes was only that our error rate was no higher than about 12.5%. So it's a very useful thing to remember. This also figures into in clinical trials. The FDA often has a number needed to treat for the minimal number needed to treat before they'd ever approve your drug. And the idea is that for something innocuous like cold medicine, they want to see that you've used it in 3,000 people minimum, maybe more than that, with the idea that anaphylaxis, a rare but extremely severe event, they would like to know that when they have observed no anaphylaxis in the clinical trials, the rate of anaphylaxis is below perhaps 1 in 1,000 rate, something like that. So. Of course, if you have n events and n trials, just turn everything around. You know, 1 minus 3 over n. To do tests for a proportion, use the binomial distribution under the null. Again, let a computer do it for you, and it will compute these probabilities by summing over the values. So they'll look at the, if you've observed k successes out of n trials, it will look at, under the null hypothesis, what's the probability that you would have observed y greater than or equal to k. And under the null hypothesis, what's the probability you'd observe y less than or equal to k? And then it will take a two-sided test that's 2 times the minimum. Well, there's other things that you could do instead, but that was the easy way to do it. Stata, you use by test. You just list your variable, and you put in the number that is the hypothesis that you want to test. It'll give upper and lower one-sided p-values as well as a two-sided p-value. The two-sided p-value that Stata compute is more complicated than the easy rule that I just gave you, but it is valid. I'm chosen because they actually think it's a little bit better. So in this case, if we were testing that the prevalence of relapse within 24 months was 40%, and I had no scientific reason to choose the number 40%, but I needed to choose something to make this slide. So I just made it up. But to test that this was equal to 40%, it gives you the following output. It tells you that having observed 22 people relapse within 24 months, it looks at if the true probability was 40%, what's the probability that you've observed at least 22? It tells you what's the probability you would observe at most 22, and then it looks at 17 and 22 as the bounds because they are somewhat surrounding D.
the observed value. And so it has a rule that it does that. It's a little bit complicated. Trust it. It's a good way to do it. So that the two-sided test is not exactly two times the minimum of those. So two-sided inference with 95% confidence, we can't reject the hypothesis that the true prevalence of relapse within 24 months is 40%. P equals 0.57, 95% confidence interval, 30% to 58.7%. And Carly, you can see that this is the way, you know, we truly, really write it rather than going into all the words. Carly asked me, discussion section this morning, why we have to go through all of the stuff that I put in there. Exact versus asymptotic, so the t-test, what's the difference? Well, we use a different mean variance relationship. In the exact test, we plug in p0. The t-test would plug in p-hat times 1 minus p-hat, because that's what the sample variance will look like. It will look like p-hat times 1 minus p-hat. Then the t-test actually divides by n minus 1 instead of dividing by n, so it doesn't really give you exactly p-hat times 1 minus p-hat, and the critical values are a little bit different. In very large samples, none of these make a difference, so just doing the t-test would have been adequate in large samples. So we just really stress using the binomial tests for prudentiary. So, yes, Rebecca.
And is that very large samples, is that the slide you showed us where
I would say, you know, somewhere probably around 50 in most cases, but it's a sucker's game because it depends upon how many events you have observed.
Okay.
So we tend to use the rule n times p is greater than 5 and n times 1 minus p is greater than 5. Sometimes we use the rule n times p 1 minus p is greater than 5. But those are rules of thumb that we use. So that's, again, just a standard more than it is a tight, you know, a tight bound. The mean variance relationship changes what that is.
I'm confused between exact, asymptotic, and t-test. Or is t-test, like, are those three separate things?
They are. They are a little bit. Because when people say, I use the asymptotic approximation to the binomial, they most often are using a Z statistic, the T statistic. My argument is I can simplify this class so much if I can just abandon the chi-square test and just tell everybody to use the T test, but I have to for a while warn you that if you try to do that, you better be prepared to fight. You know, but they're really the same thing. So conceptually, it's the same thing. There's not much difference.
Wait,
between
what's the same thing? Asymptotic.
So, yes, the Z test. The z-test for binomial proportion, and the t-test, which uses the sample variance instead of p-hat times 4 minus p-hat. There's a very slight difference. The critical value also differs. Are you using 1.96 for your critical value, or are you using all those different critical values that change by sample size? So historically, we tend, whenever we have a binary endpoint for some reason, we tend to always use 1.96. I don't think that's a good idea, I think. You know, I think that the T statistic where we adjust for the small samples might be a better thing to do. It's just an approximation. I think it will behave a little bit better. But the concept is if you have software that will do a T test for you and don't have one that will do the final test, do the T test. The major thing is we're just testing the mean. Just testing the mean. And I also try to push this idea to try to kill once again the idea that if you're using a t-test, you need normality of the data. Because binary data is far from normal.
So when you put the asymptotic t-test, you're not saying they're the same thing?
The t-test is asymptotic. There are many asymptotic tests we have that vary just a little bit in how we can. When we come to the two-sample t-tests, they're all going to be asymptotic, but there are versions that presume the variances are equal or unequal or things like this. In this case, I was taking the t-test. I gave you everything for what the t-test would do. But if, for instance, you did the standard asymptotic binomial
you would still use the estimated proportion in the standard error, but you wouldn't divide by A minus 1, and you wouldn't use the t-distribution. So this actually includes both forms. So I gave you a form that said Z instead of T. That's the difference in the formula. It's really not worth perseverating on too much other than to just explain that sometimes you'll see very slight variations. Yes?
I have a question on slide
50.
I see where you got the P is equal to 0.857.
Yes.
But with confidence intervals, is that from...
That was from by test.
Oh. Okay.
I'm sorry, that was from CI with binary, yeah. So, yeah, why Stata doesn't give it all to you at once doesn't make sense to me. So here is, if I did the t-test on this same data, again, I think you would find that this p-value is not drastically different than what the p-value would have been. But again, what's a large sample size whenever you're dealing with binary data? Is a function of how many events you've observed. Yes?
So is that saying that if you had a really small sample size, like 9 samples, then you couldn't use this?
Well, if you had 9 samples but 4 events, it wouldn't do that bad, surprisingly. But if you had 9 samples and 1 event, it would do bad. So, you know, but it's all there. Yeah, a lot of people would absolutely refuse to use the asymptotics with sample size 9. So there's lots of things we do to try to fix these things up later. I urge you not to do anything with a sample size of 9, except for if it's on this homework.
Maybe.
No, you don't need to because this is just a one sample test. When we come to two sample binomial tests, we'll be in more trouble. Yeah.
Sorry. So last thing. When it comes down to it, is there any reason that you would use an asymptotic test over a stack binomial?
In one sample? No.
Yeah.
No. If I'm gonna type in something anyway, I would rather have the exact test. But a lot of software will not give you the exact test. For those of you using R and S, they'll max out at some point because the algorithms they're using, they don't trust. N factorial gets big too fast sometimes. And so as they're doing that, they'll come to a place where they'll say, we won't give it to you. And that we're going to switch to asymptotics. Okay. Now, what if I want to know the probability of something happening, but I've got censored data? So I want to know the probability that you live more than 5 years. That's just binomial. Why can't I just solve this problem? But some of my subjects have not been observed to die. So I'm still wanting to estimate just a simple dichotomization of a population, but I've got censored data. Okay? So dichotomized continuous data, cholesterol greater than 200. Usually, we don't have censored data with cholesterol measurements. Okay? Sometimes with laboratory data, we do get censored data. Sometimes the machine is incapable of reading it above some level. But usually with cholesterol, we don't have censored data, so we just dichotomize it. But survival past 5 years, quite often we have censored data, and I can't tell you for some subjects whether they're a 0 or 1. In right censored data, the mean or median might not be estimable, and so we're forced to choose some other summary measure of our distribution. So sometimes for scientific reasons we do this, sometimes it's just we can't estimate other summary measures. So in the absence of censored data, we would have created dichotomized data and just done all of that stuff using either exact or approximate, but in the presence of right censored, we use Kaplan-Meier estimates. Kaplan-Meier estimates are asymptotically normally distributed. The mean is the true proportion, and the standard error depends on both the true proportion. We still do have the mean variance relationship, but in addition, we have to worry about the sample size at all different times. So it's a very complicated formula. But that formula is Greenwood's formula. in our data where we had the unobserved true times and true censoring times. Instead, in our observed data, we just have the minimum of the event time for the censoring time, and then we have an indicator whether it was event or censoring. We defined the intervals exactly as we described when we were talking about just the descriptive statistics. And we compute the hazard and conditional probability of survival during the interval. Again, this is straight out of lecture 6. The only point that I want to make here is that DJ over NJ sure does look like a proportion to me. And so that's what's going to lead to Greenwood's formula when we try to get the inference, is we're going to recognize that we do have a proportion that we understand its mean variance relationship. So when we estimate the survival probability, our survival probability is a product of a lot of different terms. I would want to know the variance of that product, right? And I have given you no rules on how to get the variance of a product. But I have given you rules on how to get the variance of a sum. So what do? Well, what we always do when we're confronted with a product, we take the log. Okay. So we'll take the log of this in order to get our variance. So Greenwood's formula, those of you who want to go back to sleep, do so right now. Those of you who wish you could go back to sleep, except for I'm talking to you. The basic idea, you don't have to know that for this class, only because when I made past years actually solve this, they complained so much that now I'm not making you do it. But the idea is it's a proportion. You can use the delta method. Have you had the delta method yet? Taylor's expansion. It's a Taylor's expansion that allows you to get the variance for the log of this. And then we just, again, use a delta method to go back. So it's a very simple approach that you can look this up in future years. So Greenwood's formula gives us a standard error for the term. And then we just use the normal approximation to be able to get all of this. The point estimate is the Kaplan-Meier curve at that value. The confidence interval is just going to be our point estimate plus or minus. We use the Z statistic here because we don't really have any good reason to use a T distribution here. We wouldn't know what the degrees of freedom to use is anyway. So we use the Z critical value with the standard error. So usually it's just the Kaplan-Meier estimate plus or minus 2 times the standard error. Now, I'll note that when you do this, sometimes the confidence intervals go beyond 0 or 1. Now, this can happen with the asymptotic confidence intervals and the uncensored data as well. If we go through a more complicated method, it's called the complementary log-log, or so the log, negative log of the survival, and compute the confidence intervals first on that, then we're guaranteed not to get that. So this is just to explain why when you see the output, the confidence intervals that you get from Stata may not look like what you would have gotten by taking its mean plus or minus 2 times the standard error, because this is a better method in my mind and in Stata's mind to do this. Hypothesis tests, we just take the estimate minus our hypothesized value, divide by the standard error, and look at that in the normal probability. So in the PSA data, men with prostate cancer, we're interested in estimating the probability of remaining in remission for 3 years. Why are we interested in estimating that? Well, because I didn't have to use the Kaplan-Meier for 2 years, so I have to go to 3 years here to be able to use the Kaplan-Meier estimate. We're going to test the hypothesis that the 3-year survival probability is 50%. I made that number up. Again, ideally, you'd have a scientific reason for hypothesizing something. I didn't have it. So you'd go through the Stata commands, just as you've done to get the descriptive statistics. you'd set your survival variable, you'd get your Kaplan-Meier estimates, you'd use STS list. There's our graph, probability of remaining in remission. And here's our STS list. And heretofore, we've just taken the survival function estimate, and we've ignored the standard error and the confidence interval. Now we will just take those numbers. But you can see from this very first line that 0.98 plus or minus 1.96 times 0.02 would take us higher than 1. They are using, Stata uses that log negative log survival to first compute the p-value and then transform it back. You don't have to do that, but Stata does it. It is the better approach, but you could have also just used the error straight out. And in large samples, that wouldn't be a problem. In this case, if you were trying to estimate the 1 month survival probability, well, there's such a small number of events that we'd have not enough of a sample size to be able to estimate this. But if I had more and more people estimating the 1 month survival, it would look good with the plus or minus the standard error. So you could just list at specific months. We were interested in the 3 years, so I'm most interested in the 36 month. And we find that our survivor function estimate is 0.43, so 43%. Our confidence interval, 29% to 56%. If I wanted to do a t-test, I have to compute the test myself. Stata doesn't give you this. I don't understand why. But I would have to get times the normal probability of taking the negative absolute value of 0.4318 minus 5. So again, it's estimate minus hypothesized divided by the standard error. I always just take the absolute value of that, negate it, and then do the normal probability, and that works. And I don't have to think about which number is bigger. So that would be my two-sided p-value. So this is the interpretation. Kaplan-Meier estimate, 0.432, with 95% confidence, such an observation is not consistent with a true probability less than 0.291 or greater than 0.565. Where consistent, that definition of consistent, is tied up in the 95% confidence. And based on the p-value of 0.337, I can't reject the hypothesis that 50% of hormonally treated men would remain in remission for 3 years. So then we also do things with rates when we're counting how many events have occurred in space or time. So we might estimate cancer incident rates, number of new cases of cancer diagnosed per person year of observation, or the number of colon polyps that grow in a person during a three-year period, or the number of respiratory tract infections in cystic fibrosis patients over some defined period of time. A mean normalized to a standard period of time and a standard area of space. So this is our rate, but it is just a mean. Most often, inference is based on a probability model that involves the Poisson distribution. The assumptions that lead to the Poisson are pretty strong. In a small interval of space and time, only one event can occur. That's not too bad. That one usually works. The number of events occurring in non-overlapping intervals are independent. That's the one that we often have some trouble with. There's sometimes some spatial correlation or time correlation. And that it's a constant rate would also be violating this. It's not there. But when we're most often doing person years type analysis in epidemiology, we're really using the Poisson approximation to the binomial. So it'll behave well in cases. The data for incidence rate data consists of length of the time-space interval a subject is under observation, so the person years, the number of events observed in that subject, and quite often we don't even present it on each subject, but instead we present the aggregate data. So the total person years of observation in some stratum and the total number of events across all of those subjects. Our point estimate, we just use the sample mean. So it's the number of events divided by person. from the central limit theorem. That sample mean is approximately normally distributed, but there is again a mean variance relationship with Poisson data. The mean is equal to the variance. As with the binomial distribution, the number of events is discrete. We don't usually bother with the continuity correction, because it just happened. But it would make sense to do so. The asymptotic confidence interval would take into account the mean variance relationship and a continuity correction. But more often, rather than using that lambda hat L when we're computing lambda L and the lambda hat U when we're computing that and having to go through the quadratic, we tend to just use lambda hat. Just tend to plug that in. Asymptotic p-values, same thing. The best thing to do is to use the hypothesized rate in our estimate of the standard error. So again, this looks just like our estimate minus our hypothesized value divided by our standard error. But because of the mean variance relationship, we estimate our standard error using our hypothesized value. And this is, of course, just the continuity correction. We drop the continuity correction just as a matter of convenience quite often. Stata commands, we use IR incidence rates. We give the count variable and we give the time variable that tells us the person years. It can be area as well. And in the one sample problem, exact inference is possible, but it's not as common to use exact inference for Poisson rates, probably because most times we're really just using this as an approximation to the binomial. We aren't really thinking of it as Poisson data. And then also, most often, we're in a two or more sample setting. The assumption that incidence rates might follow the Poisson distribution is a very strong one. Usually the rate is changing over time, which causes the data to be more variable than the Poisson analysis might allow for. And many times, it's just the approximate to the binomial distribution in the presence of a very low probability of an event. But the concept of that changing rate still holds. Okay, we'll skip.